is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, November 8, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The U.S. Marine Corps begin Operation Phantom Fury against the Iraqi city of Fallujah. Residents prepare for mass carnage. The fragile peace on the Ivory Coast is shattered as the government bombs the rebel-held north. And the Democrats ask for an investigation into the mounting reports of irregularities of voting machines that some believe could have tipped the election to John Kerry. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Palestinian officials are complaining about getting little information about Yasser Arafat, who is in a Paris hospital, by many accounts, fighting for his life. Top officials, including the prime minister, acting PLO leader, the parliament speaker, and foreign minister, all left occupied Palestine to go to Arafat's bedside to see his condition for themselves and determine future action. French medical officials said today that Arafat is in stable condition. Demonstrators in Germany chained themselves to railroad tracks today to stop a shipment of nuclear waste coming from France. Yesterday, a 21-year-old activist died doing the same thing. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
The young man, whose name has not been made public, lost his leg and later died after chaining himself to the tracks and being run over by a train carrying nuclear waste. In Germany, about 5,000 demonstrators and 11,000 police are waiting for the shipment of 12 spent nuclear rods to arrive from La Hague treatment plant in France. The consignment, which is the seventh to be sent back to Germany since 1996, is expected to arrive at a storage dump near the North German town of Gorleben Tuesday. The fuel rods are reprocessed in France because Germany has no treatment facilities. But environmental activists say that the waste, which stays radioactive for centuries, will pollute the water table and that moving the shipments is dangerous. Thanks to the cost of the transports and the protests that they arouse, Germany says that it will phase out nuclear plants by 2020. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
The southern Balkan country of Macedonia averted a slide towards ethnic division on Sunday. Melek Karamian explains.
At the center of the controversy are the laws aimed at restructuring local governance, called decentralization. The laws are designed to combine municipal governments into larger bodies so that the Albanian minority has more of a political voice. But little more than a quarter of Macedonia's 1.7 million eligible voters turned out to voice their opposition to such governmental concessions. Those who voted yes to abandon the decentralization process say that the international community is giving ethnic Albanians too much autonomy. The redrawn local districts will give Albanians dominance in 16 out of 84 municipalities. Western diplomats see decentralization as crucial to Macedonia's integration into NATO and the European Union. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in neighboring Kosovo, this is Melek Karamian with the Kosovo Radio Collective.
A general strike planned by India's right wing stopped normal business today as workers demanded the government do something about rising fuel prices. Binu Alex reports from Kerala.
Call for a general strike given by the right-wing BJP party was morally supported by even parties on the left. The call was against the increase of fuel prices after the government of India delayed incorporating rising world market trends in crude oil prices. The strikers demanded that the local government taxes be reduced to nullify the increase. The government has already made clear that it's not likely to heed to these demands since it is already subsidizing petroleum products. Commercial establishments and educational institutions remain closed and public transport went off the road, making it difficult for people to reach their destination. From Thrissur in Kerala, India, Benu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Texas school board officials are insisting that a textbook publisher must clearly define marriage as between a man and a woman and eliminate any ambiguous references like partner. John V. Tacker from KPFT reports.
Because Texas is one of the nation's largest textbook buyers, Friday's vote could set the trend for books used in public schools across the country. A day before the final vote, the board had objected to the use of the word partners as an asexual stealth phrase in the definition of marriage. This forced publishers to rewrite the description of marriage as between a man and a woman instead of when two people marry in order to get the textbooks approved. From KPFT, I'm Janvi Thacker for Free Speech Radio News.
Women are the fastest rising population in the U.S. prison system. Noelle Hanrahan has more from Prison Radio.
According to the U.S. Department of Justice, more women than ever are now behind bars, 101,000 women in state and federal prisons, a 48% increase since 1995. The vast majority of these women were convicted of nonviolent offenses. Black women are six times more likely to go to prison than white women. Latinas are three times more likely to do time. As local and state governments cope with deficits, the issues of parole, three strikes reform, and draconian drug laws will be raised in elections from coast to coast. But for now, more women will do more time. This is Noelle Hanrahan in San Francisco for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Marine Corps began Operation Phantom Fury against the Iraqi city of Fallujah today by seizing the municipal hospital. The Arab satellite channel Al Jazeera today quoted one of the doctors at the hospital as saying all the doctors and patients were arrested. From Baghdad, Salam Talib has more.
At 4 a.m., Iraqi and American soldiers raided and took control of the main hospital in Fallujah. They also took control of two bridges leading into the city. 1,500 families are fleeing from Fallujah to the desert and nearby cities. A spokesman from the Red Crescent said that they don't have enough supplements such as tents, medical and food in order to properly care for the families. The U.S. military claimed to have killed 38 fighters already. A suicide car bomb exploded on the airport route, hitting vehicle carrying foreigners and missionaries. Yesterday, 23 policemen were executed at a police station in Haditha. Also yesterday, 12 Iraqi National Guards members were executed when they were returning home to Najaf. Yesterday, martial laws were detected for 60 days by the interim government here. This means they can raid any house and detain anyone who caught suspicious. They give a Prime Minister Alawi permission to do anything he feels necessary for security purposes, similar to the Patriot Act 1 and 2 in the United States. The so-called Green Zone continue to be mortared, and heavily gun battles have broken out around Baghdad today as well as the past week. The mood here is very tense, while everyone wait to see what will happen now that the siege of the Fallujah has begun. This is Salam Talib for Free Speech Radio News, Baghdad.
When the U.S. military last laid siege to Fallujah, so many people were killed that the municipal football field had to be turned into a mass grave for the dead. Residents of Fallujah are already beginning to dig trenches for the anticipated carnage, but burying the dead will be a difficult task because American soldiers have orders to shoot to kill anything that moves. Aaron Glantz reports.
The Bush administration is throwing all it has against the city of Fallujah, the center of the Iraqi resistance. A torrent of American tanks, armored vehicles, F-16s, and AC-130 gunships are taking part in the attack. At a press conference at the Pentagon, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said he couldn't imagine ending the attack before the mission is accomplished.
Over time, you'll find that the process of tipping will take place, that more and more of the Iraqis will be angry about the fact that their innocent people are being killed by the extremists, a number of them from outside the country, and they won't like it. And that they'll want elections. And the more they see the extremists acting against that possibility of elections, I think that they'll turn on those people.
But while Rumsfeld speaks in measured tones in Washington, American military commanders in the field are using different language. At the U.S. Marine base outside the city, Colonel Gary Brattle told Scottish television, quote, "The enemy has a face. It is Satan's. He is in Fallujah, and we are going to destroy him." The comments of another commander have Amnesty International concerned. Bethann Tupin is Amnesty's Iraq specialist.
If I see someone who looks like a martyr driving at high speed toward my unit, I'll send him to Allah before he gets close.
Tupin is quoting Lieutenant Colonel Mike Ramos, also stationed outside Fallujah. He told the Associated Press his troops would have orders to shoot anything that moved. The last time U.S. troops laid siege to Fallujah, there were at least two confirmed cases where American troops attacked ambulances. Today, Al Jazeera reported new U.S. attack on an ambulance. Again, Bethann Tupin of Amnesty International.
U.S. troops will be allowed to shoot and kill anyone carrying a weapon or driving in Fallujah. Problem with not being able to drive. So there's no way to get the wounded quickly to a place of aid. So it's not really clear how accessible medical treatment will be.
The order also means it will be almost impossible for civilians to flee Fallujah as the fighting intensifies, and it means most estimates of civilian casualties reported by hospital officials will be lower than the actual tally, since many of the wounded will be unable to leave their homes. Some may die because they lack medical care. In addition, Fallujah's main hospital has been taken over by the U.S. military, meaning the town will have only two small clinics to care for what likely will be thousands of wounded. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
In these post-election days, many articles have been circulating on the internet that claim that John Kerry actually won the election or that the voting process was rigged. Today, Democratic lawmakers asked the Government Accountability Office to investigate voting irregularities of electronic voting machines in several key states. In a letter to the GAO, three House representatives cite a case in Ohio which gave President Bush nearly 4,000 extra votes, and another case in Florida where there was a substantial drop-off in Democratic votes in proportion to the voter registration in counties that used optical scan machines. Mitch Jeserich has more.
Headed by the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers from Detroit, three Democratic lawmakers are requesting that the Government Accountability Office investigate how electronic voting machines performed in the 2004 elections. The letter also requests that the GAO take a look at how election officials responded to difficulties posed by the machines. Democratic Representative Gerald Nadler also signed on to the letter.
One of the things about elections is not only that elections have to be fair, they have to be seen to be fair. I mean, you shouldn't have an election where somebody wins and then a good portion of the population wonders whether he really won or not. And that clearly can happen when we have these electronic voting machines and these other technologies that don't give you paper trails.
Do you think John Kerry conceded too soon?
No, I'm not saying that. We don't have the kind of evidence that would lead to say that at this point. It's conceivable that such evidence will arise, but it's very conceivable it won't. No, there was a 3% difference in the vote, and I would be surprised, frankly, if voting machines accounted for that. But it's not out of the question.
But you're not seeking any kind of a recount?
Certainly not. As of right now, we're simply saying, listen, we may have been lucky in this election. We introduced all these new electronic voting machines without paper trails. We have lots of suspicions. We have lots of indications things went wrong. Let's look into these and change the procedures so that next time we don't have the reality or the suspicions that things went wrong.
Representative Nadler is a co-sponsor of a bill that would require electronic voting machines to provide a paper trail. The bill was rejected by the House Republican leadership last year. There are several cases nationwide of voting irregularities with electronic voting machines. In Franklin County in the Columbus, Ohio region, a computer error gave George Bush an extra 3,893 votes in a precinct with only 638 voters. Bush won Ohio's 20 Electoral College votes by defeating Kerry by 136,000 votes. Kerry conceded to Bush, saying that the 155,000 provisional ballots yet to be counted would not have been enough for a victory. But Bev Harris, executive director of Black Box Voting, says the actual number of provisional ballots in Ohio is yet unknown, which she says illustrates another problem that has popped up with electronic voting machines.
The estimates are going from 150,000 to 500,000, depending on who you talk to. And from what I understand, the Kerry campaign was given an assurance there was no more than 150,000 provisional ballots. Well, we've been trying now for a week to get any kind of source documents that tell us how many are there and what record was kept. And then they gave us this bizarre answer that said, well, they're still coming in. Well, that's the wrong answer, because provisionals are cast on election day at the polling place. And if they're properly accounted for, we should know exactly how many were cast.
Bev Harris is using the Freedom of Information Act to obtain internal computer logs from 3,000 different counties because she says she believes problems with electronic voting is more widespread than what has been reported.
The anomalies we're finding, though, are pretty much across the board, and the common denominator is that it was counted by a computer at some stage along the way. Even punch cards are counted by a computer at the end.
According to a report by the Coalition Election Protection 2004, there were reports nationwide of voters having to wait several hours in line due to malfunctioning electronic machines. In Ohio, there have been reports of some voters waiting as long as 8 hours to cast their votes. Election Protection also says there were numerous nationwide complaints of disabled voters who continue to have difficulty gaining access to the polls. Mitch Jezrich, Free Speech Radio News.
In the West African nation of the Ivory Coast, the 18-month-long peace truce was shattered late last week when government forces carried out bombing raids on the rebel-held north of the country. Since independence in 1960, Ivory Coast has been a nation of relative stability, described as the economic capital of West Africa. However, since 1999, the country has suffered a number of coups d'etats, followed by a full-blown rebellion in 2000. The rebels now occupy the north, and the government controls the southern part of the country. Over the weekend, government supporters turned on French troops who were in the Ivory Coast as part of the so-called peacekeeping mission, as suspicion grew that France was going to depose the president. Joining us now on FSRN is Philippe Djangongbi, ambassador and permanent representative of the Ivory Coast to the United Nations. Mr. Ambassador, it seems that an 18-month truce or peace deal was shattered late last week when the government fired on the rebel-held north. Why did this happen?
This happened because the rebels were preparing to attack the legal authorities, and the suffering of the people has been going on for more than 2 years now. Our economy is being destroyed by rebellion, and they refused to disarm. And we took the initiative because the situation could be rotten and people could rebel against the legal authorities. We might have a rebellion within a rebellion and a more chaotic situation.
Mr. Ambassador, what proof did the government have that there was going to be an uprising or some attacks by the rebels?
We are an organized state, and we have our sources of information, of course. We have our intelligence. We know that they were preparing to attack, and we know that they were recruiting foreigners and foreign mercenaries, and we know very well, they said it publicly, that they will never disarm because they are not satisfied with all the efforts that have been made thus far by the legal authorities.
Many in the international community have actually condemned the attacks, including the United Nations and France. How do you respond to them?
Well, what France is doing right now in Côte d'Ivoire is totally outside the mandate of ONUC. They are targeting the presidential palace. They have destroyed all the aircraft of Côte d'Ivoire. This is not what the Security Council sent them to Côte d'Ivoire to do. The condemnation of Côte d'Ivoire was made on a false basis when they were meeting to take a position on the matter. Only the incident about the collateral damage, which is normal in any war, unfortunately, and which we regret, it was only on the basis of the collateral damage, which has purportedly killed French people, that the Security Council condemned the action.
The conflict has obviously restarted. There was 18 months of peace. Now that's been shattered. How does the government plan to ensure security of people who live across the country? Because the rebels, no doubt, will retaliate.
This was not 18 months of peace. This was 18 months of no war, no peace. With our economy being looted, with people suffering in the north, with 2 million people, displaced people in the south from the north, people held hostage. Do you call that 18 months of peace? We took our responsibility. If we have our dignity, we have our responsibility. If there is a rebellion, we should never encourage rebellion to prosper, because there will never be a lasting peace in the sub-region.
And Mr. Ambassador, will the government of the Ivory Coast share with the international community the evidence they have that the rebels were planning an attack? Because at this stage, it looks like the rebels are justified in saying they were attacked without cause.
Will the French people show the evidence that we targeted them intentionally, madam? Because the retaliation we are suffering now is on the basis of presentation made by the French saying that our planes targeted them intentionally. And people base themselves on that without asking the proof, without asking for evidence, without any inquiry. If you answer to that, if one can answer clearly to that question, then I can answer to your question.
Philip Jungong Bi, Ambassador and Permanent Representative of the Ivory Coast to the United Nations. And while violence continues in various African nations, many on the continent say that Western nations such as the US and France are selective in their aid and peacekeeping involvement, and that due to their economic interests in the region are oftentimes to blame for the violent conflicts. The ever-deepening poverty of the continent comes as multinational corporations get richer. At a recent meeting of the Commission for Africa in Addis Ababa, heads of state and policy experts gathered to discuss ways to alleviate the continuing impoverishment of millions of Africans across the continent. Fair trade campaigners called on the Western world to open up markets for African exports, as well as granting a fairer deal for African producers of commodities like coffee. As Rupert Cook reports from Tanzania, while the coffee processing multinationals are increasing their profits, small-scale farmers are sinking ever deeper into poverty.
This coffee price is never paying anything. We are working good for nothing because it doesn't pay. It never does anything.
Jonas Kassan is a 53-year-old smallholder farmer in Shari Village near Mount Kilimanjaro in northern Tanzania. Kilimanjaro's high-altitude slopes make the region ideal for coffee's cultivation. Tanzanian coffee only amounts to about 1% of global production, but its quality is among the best in the world. The livelihoods of 2 million Tanzanians still depend upon coffee, many of them concentrated in the Kilimanjaro area. Almost every smallholder here used to grow coffee, but that was when the coffee price was high. In the last decade, it suffered a precipitous decline, from $8 a kilo to about $1.50 today. Globally, the coffee business is worth about $70 billion and growing. The world's producers and their dependents, like Jonas Kassan and his family in Shari Village, receive just $5 billion of this burgeoning trade. Many observers believe that there's an underlying inequity in the profiteering of global multinationals at the expense of coffee producers. Edwin Inte is the elected chairman of the Tanzanian Coffee Research Institute.
I think there is something fundamentally wrong because we receive such a small proportion that we feel we are being forced to abandon the industry. I believe that we could actually mount a campaign to persuade the big multinationals who are getting the windfall, the profits, at least to ensure that the source of their wealth gets rewarded in such a manner that not only for fair play, but to ensure durability and sustainability for the coffee industry in the future.
Almost all the coffee farmers in the Kilimanjaro region have been operating at a loss for years, with their other crops or livestock subsidizing coffee. But today, most farmers have run out of cows to sell. The majority of those who remain on the land are elderly. There's an air of desperation as they discuss alternatives. James Terry is the director of the Tanzanian Coffee Research Institute.
Every farmer we have talked to is very, very, very concerned about the declining prices from coffee because they have no alternative sources of income. They are unable to feed themselves. There is increased malnutrition in the rural areas, especially among children. They cannot afford to send their kids to school. They cannot afford health services. And in most areas you will visit, you will not only see old coffee trees, you will also see old coffee farmers because the young men are running away from the farms. They don't want to be trapped to the coffee like their parents.
Back in the village of Shari, Jonas Kassan has a simple message for the outside world.
I would ask kindly, they look for these small farmers, that they are suffering just working for producing this coffee. And when they give us good price, we are actually very, 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 very much interested to go on processing this coffee.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Moshi, Tanzania.
The state of South Dakota recently completed public hearings on the Indian Child Welfare Act. A special commission spent 2 months accepting testimony from American Indian families who complained that the federal law written to protect Indian children from placement in non-Indian homes has been routinely violated by the state's Department of Social Services. But as Jim Kent reports, American Indian families also see the state's Department of Corrections as the enemy in their efforts to keep Indian children in Indian homes.
The Parents Who Care Coalition was founded in 1999 as a support group for American Indian and non-American Indian parents with children in South Dakota's Department of Corrections. Spokesperson Deb Phillips became involved in the coalition after her daughter became caught up in the system.
My daughter was a CHINS child, a child in need of supervision. She had never committed a crime. She was a status offender, truancy, skipping school, that type of thing. And she was in front of a judge 3 times and placed into the Department of Corrections.
Phillips was fortunate that her daughter was never actually placed in a correctional facility, though she says corrections agents frequently threatened her with such a move. She notes that part of the problem is the amount of power that's given to corrections agents.
They're overstepping their bounds. I've got one parent that's called me and talked to me, and her juvenile correction agent has gone against the recommendations of the professional people where he was placed at, said they told her that he was ready to come home without patient counseling and family counseling. The juvenile correction agent has come in and said, no, they're going to this program. And this stuff is done without going in front of a judge or into court.
Phillips adds that many complaints to her group are directed toward the South Dakota Department of Social Services, which is frequently a first step toward children being placed into the Department of Corrections. Far too often, according to Lakota elder Alfred Boneshirt, that situation goes from bad to worse.
You know, there was a lot of cases where kids, they said they assaulted maybe a staff member or got belligerent. But the ploy they always used was that the child used a pencil and stuck somebody. They elevate their case immediately into the Department of Corrections.
Mirroring concerns with the South Dakota Department of Social Services, Boneshirt sees the motive for such actions in the millions of federal dollars the state receives each year for juvenile corrections. Boneshirt notes that there's an added boost from Bureau of Indian Affairs funding for American Indian children in the system. Complaints over what happens to children once they're in the state correctional system range from disregarding traditional cultural beliefs by cutting the hair of American Indian children to failing to allow private telephone conversations between children and their parents. But even with Deb Phillips noting that incidents of abuse and racial comments have been reduced over recent years, Department of Corrections spokesman Michael Winder refused to discuss what he referred to as the same old issues.
Because we've gone through those issues as recently as May, we're just not going to commit time to keep going through these.
Although the state's all-Democrat U.S. congressional delegation declined invitations to discuss the issues, former Republican state legislator Larry Dietrich did find time to listen to Phillips and her supporters at a meeting in Hot Springs. Dietrich is running against Democrat Stephanie Herseth for the state's lone U.S. House of Representatives seat. After hearing the parents' complaints with the state's Department of Corrections and Department of Social Services, Dietrich commented that it's pretty obvious that there's a problem with the system.
From what I heard today, we have some real issues. I certainly hope, especially in South Dakota, that we don't have agencies where their goal is to do what they can to harm the family structure that we have in this state that's so very important just because they can receive some more dollars from the federal level. I'm not going to accuse them at this point of doing that, but certainly I think it's well worth an investigation.
That investigation can't come too soon for Deb Phillips and the hundreds of other parents who see their children as the fuel to keep the budgetary fires of South Dakota's Department of Corrections burning brightly with federal funding. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent with the Parents Who Care Coalition in Hot Springs, South Dakota.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.